Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and you're about to hear the recording of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, March 4th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's listen to what the National Weather Service has in its forecast for today. Showers are likely before 3 p.m., then showers are likely and possibly a thunderstorm between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m., then a chance of showers and thunderstorms after 5, increasing clouds with a high near 57, east wind 8 to 15 miles per hour, becoming north in the afternoon, winds could gust as high as 23 miles per hour, chance of precipitation is 60%. New rainfall amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch, except higher amounts possible where there are thunderstorms. For tonight, we have a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 9 p.m. It will be cloudy, then gradually becoming partly cloudy, with a low around 32 degrees for the evening. North wind, 9 to 15 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 28 miles per hour. New precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch, except again higher where there are possible thunderstorms. On Tuesday morning tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high near 55, north-northeast wind 6 to 10 miles per hour, and in the evening tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a low around 32 degrees. Wednesday will be partly sunny with a high near 56, and Wednesday night, there will be a 30% chance of rain, mainly after midnight. Mostly cloudy, with a low around 34 for the evening on Wednesday. Then Thursday, a 40% chance of rain again, mostly cloudy, with a high near 52. And the evening on Thursday, there's a 50% chance of rain, again mostly cloudy, with a low around 36 degrees. We'll keep that 30 to 40% chance of rain throughout the week until Saturday, which will be mostly sunny with a high near 49 degrees and breezy on Saturday. Now let's turn to the front page of the Courier. There are two articles to read today. The first one is titled Top of the Heap, Sportscaster of the Year. After viral fame, Woodley recognized for work in sports. And the story begins with a photograph of KWWL sportscaster Mark Woodley, who was recently named the 2023 Iowa Sportscaster of the Year by the National Sports Media Association. Dateline Waterloo. Mark Woodley is back in the news. Yes, that Mark Woodley. The KWWL-TV sportscaster, who gained international attention when a video of his snarky turn as a weather reporter went viral, was recently named the 2023 Iowa Sportscaster of the Year by the National Sports Media Association. Quote, "It was a bit of a surprise," Woodley said. "I knew I was nominated, but when I got the call, I thought they were messing with me." Quote, "Honestly, people like Keith Murphy from WHO and Sound Off, who I watched when I went to Central College in Pella, he is incredible at what he does. I've been nominated with him twice, and I don't feel like my name should be out there with his. But it's really cool that it is," unquote. That is the second time Woodley has won the honor, the first being in 2020. Quote, "The first time was a little shocking," he said. "That was before the weather thing, and my name isn't out there as much." He celebrated by going out to dinner with his wife, Rachel. Quote, "We were under COVID restrictions at the time, so I couldn't celebrate with friends." Quote, "We have a bar in our garage that opens to the alley, so we had some drinks out there with my mom and my sister. Then my friends start driving through the alley and honking. My wife set it all up. I didn't know anything about it. It was like a little parade. It was pretty great," unquote. Woodley plans to travel to North Carolina this summer to attend the NSMA's awards weekend and convention to collect his prize. In 2021, sportscasting icon Jim Nance handed him his award. Woodley, 47, and Rachel met in college and have been married for 24 years. She is a teacher at East High School. The pair have three kids. Gwen is a freshman at Hawkeye Community College, and Evelyn is a sophomore at Dyke New Hartford High School, and Colin, a sixth grader at Dyke New Hartford Junior High. Woodley graduated from Dyke New Hartford in 1995 and then studied at Central College. He interned at KWWL in the spring of 2000 and worked at KGAN in Cedar Rapids and KIMT in Mason City before returning to Waterloo in the fall of 2004. He worked mostly for KWWL since. Quote, "I've been with KWWL for 17 years," he said. "I did leave for a short time and worked at Principal and MUD. I was not cut out for a normal job. My wife told me, quote, "It's nice we see you more, but you are miserable. You're bumming us out," unquote. Quote, "It did make me appreciate my job more." Woodley said he considers longtime KWWL news anchor Ron Steele a mentor. Quote, "Ron is the best to ever do it," he said. "I've always been impressed by Ron Steele. It's still surreal for me to work with him, even though it's been almost 20 years, unquote. Woodley didn't hesitate when asked about his most memorable sports-related experience. He leaned back in his chair and solemnly said, quote, "Watching the Cubs win the World Series," unquote. Woodley said he feels for all those fans who waited so long for a title and didn't get to experience it. Quote, "I had a 97-year-old neighbor who was a lifelong Cubs fan, and he passed away before they won," unquote. Regardless, Woodley found a way to celebrate with him. Quote, "After the game, we went to visit his grave, and we had a couple of old styles with him," unquote. Another memorable experience was when Woodley got to cover the University of Iowa Hawkeyes in the 2016 Rose Bowl. Quote, "It was exciting. It was the first time Iowa had been there in a couple of decades." Quote, "KWWL sent five people out to Pasadena," he said. "Ron, a field reporter, myself and others for 9 days. It was a big deal. I never have a crew with me. It's me working the camera, doing the editing and the writing," unquote. Woodley was sent out to California a few days before the rest of the team to cover the Hawkeyes' visit to Disneyland before the game. Quote, "I was the advance team," he said. "So I'm at Disneyland, and I'm supposed to give live at 6 o'clock from inside the park. The park is jammed. The cell towers are jammed. I'm editing on my laptop, sitting on a curb." A member of the Disney staff noticed Woodley struggling and offered to set him up with a workspace. Quote, "They take me to a break area behind the Ariel's Undersea Adventure ride, where I get to hear Sebastian sing his song every 7 or 8 seconds for an hour, surrounded by headless Disney characters eating sandwiches. All the magic's gone." But Disney's provided a park photographer, two lighting guys, grips, basically a crew of 9. I think they were very aware of their image, but that was the best-looking live shot I've ever done, unquote. Woodley did confess he is terrified to speak in front of groups, an unexpected admission from a television sportscaster. Quote, "When I'm on air, I'm talking to a camera. I can't see everybody," he said. "In front of groups, the adrenaline is going. I get more and more nervous." Quote, "In high school, I did some acting and speech. I was terrified every time. I don't even like talking on the phone. But I'm getting better. I make my own doctor appointments now," unquote. Woodley still gets comments about his viral weather video, which captured his displeasure with being asked to report on and in pre-dawn blizzard conditions and sub-zero temperatures on December 22, 2022. Woodley used clips from his coverage to create a 90-second video he posted on Facebook for his family and friends. Quote, "My sister-in-law saw it and said, 'This is pretty funny,' he said. She encouraged me to post it on Twitter. I was reluctant at first. It was just me complaining and trying to entertain myself," unquote. Woodley conceded and posted the video later that day. Quote, "I was expecting my usual 20 to 30 likes," he said. He underestimated, to say the least. Quote, "My wife made me keep the volume on my phone up and it was dinging like 100 plus times a minute. It was out of control, unquote. The video was retweeted by the likes of former NBA player Rex Chapman, director and producer Judd Apatow, actor and comedian David Cross, actor Joss Gad, the voice of Olaf in Frozen, journalist and television personality Piers Morgan, and Katie Couric. The next day, Woodley appeared on the 5 o'clock news with Steele. Quote, Ron said something about Kim Kardashian staring at it, and I thought it was a joke, he said. She put it on her Instagram and has like 300 million followers, unquote. Woodley was in high demand once the video went viral. TMZ called, he said. Also the Washington Post, CNN, BBC, some station in Israel. Quote, a friend told me to do the interviews. He said, say yes, because this will end as quickly as it started. Then Ray Gunn made the shirt, and Hertz made the donut. It was insane for 2 weeks, then nothing. Woodley's tweet garnered more than 33 million views. Quote, it was bizarre, he said. It was a whirlwind. It just seems surreal at this point, like, did that really happen? Unquote. Woodley was certain that there would be at least one benefit from the exposure. Quote, I thought my kids would think I was cool, he said, but they are pretty good at keeping me humble. My oldest thought it was cool, but my middle daughter was embarrassed, and my son was like, meh. Quote, but I do get asked to speak to groups a lot more since that happened. House passes bill changing funding and oversight of the AEAs. Story written by Caleb McCullough. Dateline, Des Moines. A proposal by Iowa House Republicans to reorganize the funding and oversight of Iowa's area education agencies was passed out of chamber on Thursday, the first major milestone for the proposal, as lawmakers have spent the last 2 months weighing major changes to the state's special education network. House Republicans proposed the bill after they blocked a more expansive and dramatic proposal from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, that would have allowed school districts to spend their special education dollars outside the AEAs. The House bill, House File 2617, would keep Iowa's AEAs as the sole provider of special education support in the state. State funding for special education services would go to the school districts, and they would be required to use that funding with the AEAs. School districts would receive their allocation for media services and other education services that are currently devoted to the AEAs, and they would be able to choose whether to use that money with the AEAs or with another party once the bill is fully phased in the 2026-27 school year. The bill passed out of the House with a vote of 53-41, with only Republican votes in favor. 9 Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the bill. House Education Committee Chair Schuyler Wheeler of Hull said he introduced the bill on the floor that was the product of countless hours of conversation with stakeholders. He said there is broad agreement that changes need to be made to the AEA system. Quote, one thing was true throughout all of this. Everybody agreed that there were ways to improve and that we could make changes, Wheeler said. Quote, the AEAs have been included in this conversation more than anybody. We've worked diligently, and I'm proud of the work that we've done, unquote. In a statement after House lawmakers passed the bill, Reynolds said test scores and a, quote, needs assistance designation from the U.S. Department of Education show that the AEA system is failing Iowa students. Quote, the system must provide transparency and accountability to school districts, those closest to our students, and drive consistency across the AEA regions to improve services for students with disabilities, she said. That's what I've heard from over 100 school districts as I've traveled around the state, and I look forward to more conversations as the legislation moves forward, unquote. Democrats call for study. Democrats said there is no need for changes to the AEA system, and that the call for changes was based on faulty assumptions about test scores and performance of students with disabilities. Democrats said they supported the piece of the bill that calls for a task force to study the structure and services of the AEAs, but they did not want to make any changes before convening that study group. What is in the bill? Iowa's 9 AEAs, which are government agencies separate from the Department of Education, provide special education support to school districts in their boundaries and assist with classroom equipment and media services, professional development, and talented and gifted instruction, among other services. Right now, the services are largely funded by property taxes and federal special education dollars. Beyond the funding changes, the bill would bring the AEAs under the Department of Education and create a new state division of special education to oversee them. The division would handle oversight and federal and state compliance for educating students with disabilities. The bill would move the AEA's governing boards to an advisory capacity and require state approval of AEA budgets. The salary for AEA administrators would be capped at 125% of the average salary of all superintendents within the AEA's boundary. The bill would also establish a task force to study the AEAs led by the legislative leaders of both parties. The group would assess and make recommendations related to the property owned by the AEAs, the services they provide, the accountability and oversight measures in place, the organization structure of special education in Iowa, and a timeline for staffing modifications at the AEAs. Republicans amended the bill on the floor on Thursday that would bring back the option for school districts and AEAs to share staff like social workers and special education coordinators. The amendment also makes the number of regional employees in the State Division of Special Education flexible, with up to 40 employees split between the 9 AEAs. The division would hire 13 new employees who would be based in Des Moines. Cautious support. Two Republicans who have, in the past, opposed some education priorities of their party said during debate they were not thrilled about the bill, but they ultimately supported it because they did not think it would hurt special education offerings in the state. Representative Brent Segrist, a Republican from Council Bluffs, said he was not happy with how the bill came about, but that the House version was a major improvement. He said the bill gives him some heartburn, but that it is a step in the right direction. Quote, "It's fair to say this was on nobody's agenda coming into the session," Segrist said. "None of us heard about it going door to door, but this issue was brought to us, and I congratulate Representative Wheeler and everybody else that's worked on this to try to make something that is certainly palatable to move ahead," unquote. Republicans widely opposed Reynolds' initial proposal to change the AEA system at the beginning of this year. Reynolds quickly proposed an amendment after receiving a flood of feedback from lawmakers and legislators, and that proposal has been amended further by the Senate. The Senate proposal, Senate File 2386, has moved out of committee, but it has not reached a floor vote. The bill differs significantly from the House proposal, and it would allow schools to seek special education services outside the AEAs. The chambers will need to agree on a single bill in order to send it to Reynolds to be signed into law. Improving outcomes. Wheeler said the criticism coming from Democrats revolved around the priorities and motivations of the governor's original bill, and not the House bill. He said the House bill was not based on any test scores or the report that motivated Reynolds' proposal by Guidehouse, a Virginia-based firm. Wheeler said a number of school superintendents were on board with the bill, who said they would be able to personalize their special education services and spend their money more efficiently. He also noted that several organizations who were originally against the bill had switched their registration to undecided. 6 Leap Day babies were born at Allen. Story written by Courier staff, and the dateline is Waterloo. The story begins with the photograph of Bryce's Allison of Dubuque, was the lone baby born on Leap Day at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. The mother and father are Susanna and Bob Allison. Unity Point Health Allen Hospital celebrated Leap Day on Thursday by welcoming 6 newborns, also known as leaplings, in its birthing center. To commemorate the occasion, families were presented with Leap Day apparel, specifically an infant frog hat and a onesie that says, "I'm leaping into life." Understandably, frogs are the mascot for leaplings. Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center is also reporting one baby, Bryce's Allison of Dubuque, who was wrapped in cloth with frogs to acknowledge the significance of the day. Quote, "I only know one person who is a Leap Day baby, so when I was told we would be expecting March 7th, I was hoping she'd come early," said Susie Allison of Dubuque. Quote, "It's surreal that it actually happened," unquote. Allison and her husband Bob welcomed their daughter, nicknamed Breezy, at 7:45 p.m. Their third child weighs 7 pounds 11 ounces and was given a name with ties to Greek mythology after recalling a super sweet person they'd met with the name on a 5-year anniversary trip to Scottsdale, Arizona in 2022. Only one in 1,461 people are born on Leap Day. Most leaplings will choose to celebrate February 28th or March 1st as their birthday in the off years. Leap year exists in large part to keep the months in sync with annual events, including equinoxes and solstices, according to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology. It's a correction to counter the fact that Earth's orbit isn't precisely 365 days a year. The trip takes about 6 hours longer than that, NASA says. Contrary to what some might believe, however, not every 4 years is a leaper. Adding a leap day every 4 years would make the calendar longer by more than 44 minutes, according to the National Air and Space Museum. Years divisible by 100 do not follow the 4-year leap day rule unless they are also divisible by 400, the JPL notes. In the past 500 years, there was no leap day in 1700, 1800, 1900, but 2000 had one. In the next 500 years, if the practice is followed, there will be no leap day in 2100, 2200, 2300, and 2500. The next leap years are 2028, 2032, and 2036. Man arrested in 100-mile-per-hour chase. Story by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Evansdale. A Wellman man has been arrested following a high-speed chase through Evansdale and Waterloo on Wednesday night. A Black Hawk County Sheriff's deputy attempted to pull over a Nissan Altima for a bad brake light in the area of Gilbert Drive around 7:35 p.m. The Nissan sped off and turned onto Jones Road, hitting curbs and running stop signs, before finding its way to Dubuque Road, where speeds hit 100 miles per hour in a 55-mile-per-hour zone. Another officer set up stop sticks at the South Elk Run Road intersection, but the Nissan continued driving on rims after the device took out its tires. The fleeing vehicle headed back toward Waterloo and eventually came to a stop. The driver ran off and was detained a short time later in the backyard at 2825 Lafayette Street. Inside the vehicle, they found 6 glass tubes with methamphetamine residue. Deputies arrested Nick Eugene Temple, 55, for eluding, interference, and possession of meth. Bond was set at $16,000. Woman arrested for July stabbing. Filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A woman has been returned to Waterloo to face charges on a July stabbing. Japria Jamaica Jones, 31, made her initial appearance in Black Hawk County District Court on charges of willful injury causing serious injury and domestic assault with a weapon on Wednesday. Bond was set at $30,000. Authorities allege she stabbed her boyfriend, Joseph Joyce Jr., during an argument at their Meadow Lane apartment on July 23rd of 2023. Joyce suffered multiple stab wounds, including two to the back that penetrated a lung. During the fight, Joyce attempted to disarm Jones and threw her to the ground, causing a minor stab wound to her chest, according to court records. At the time of the stabbing, Jones was on probation for an August 2022 incident where she and two others entered an Ulta beauty store in Ames, shoved $14,000 worth of fragrances into tote bags, and ran from the shop. Following the stabbing, she was sent to prison to serve time for theft. Waterloo teen in stable condition following stabbing during a fight. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo teen is in stable condition after she was stabbed by another youth during a fight in Waterloo Thursday night. Details of the incident remain under investigation, but police said the 16-year-old girl was taken to Mercy One Medical Center in Cedar Falls around 7:40 p.m. Police were called to the hospital and determined the stabbing happened in Waterloo. The girl was also moved to Mercy One Medical Center Waterloo for further care. Officers said the girl was stabbed several times during a large fight near Riverfront Stadium, police said. No arrests have been made in the case as of Friday morning. Judge sides with city on raising house. Fatal Waterloo fire in 2022 burned building. Jeff Reinitz writes a story that has a dateline of Waterloo, and it begins with a black and white photograph of the charred house with a fireman walking next to it. A district court judge has sided with the city in a case to tear down the burned-out home where a Waterloo man died in August of 2022. Tony Lewis Grider, 60, died when he was trapped in his upstairs bedroom as fire swept through his home at 309 East 2nd Street. Two other occupants escaped, and a third was arrested on arson and murder charges for allegedly setting the fatal blaze. The charred house has remained vacant since the fire. In June 2023, the City of Waterloo went to court to seize the address under Iowa Code 657A, a statute that allows governments to claim vacant and dilapidated properties. During a brief hearing on Wednesday, attorney Christopher Wendland, who represented the city, argued that the house is open to the elements, the windows and doors were broken by the fire, and efforts to fight the flames, and is uninhabitable, except for wildlife that have taken up residence. The request was uncontested, and Grider's relatives didn't attend the hearing. Authorities said the fire started with gasoline that was poured and ignited on the front porch. Grider's friend, 60-year-old John Walter Spooner, was convicted of first-degree arson in the blaze and was sentenced to prison. He is also charged with murder in the fire and is awaiting trial. Last year, experts for the defense examined the house and claimed the fire started inside the home, possibly under a couch, or with an electrical outlet in the living room. Trial in the murder case is tentatively set for April. And now, listeners, we would just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, March 4th, on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this message.
It only took Jeff one interview to land his job, one smile to get his wife to go out with him, and one time to risk it all by trying meth. Meth, never, ever Visit YourLiveIowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
And now let's turn back to local news from the Courier. Cedar Falls looking at need for downtown ramp. Differences of opinion aired as input gathered by project consultants. Story written by Andy Malone. And we open with a color photograph of vehicles parked in the 200 block of Main Street in downtown Cedar Falls in February of 2024. And we can see that all the parking spaces are full. Dateline Cedar Falls. Differences of opinion were on display Monday and Tuesday during two meetings focused on downtown public parking. The meetings at the library also highlighted the many factors that go into discussions about potential changes to alleviate issues around limited parking spaces. Among the thoughts shared in response to questions posed by the city's consultants, John Foster and Joshua Rosenboom, with Fishbeck, are that parking requirements and structures are necessary. Others said parking requirements and a ramp are unnecessary and potential impediments to downtown's success. Quote, why is our downtown awesome? It's because it was built when there were no parking requirements. It's ironic, said John Tabor, a downtown resident. Quote, and then we get a piecemealing of parking all over the place, and it's places where people don't want to be, unquote. Fishbeck is tasked with coming up with solutions to the challenges facing the community. Many people believe parking issues are a good problem to have because it signals the downtown is thriving. Quote, the question is, what's stifling downtown? I think it's because you're required to provide parking. That's stifling certain development that could be very valuable to the city, Tabor added, while acknowledging that businesses need some parking to support their operations. The discussion and other community input is intended to provide insight on whether a ramp is needed during times people can't easily find parking near their destinations. The consultants hope to have some answers by this summer. Forster said most of their several dozen clients have been told they don't need a ramp and instead should tap into and improve other areas within their parking systems before the big expenditure is necessary. For some meeting attendees, though, it's already evident that it's time to spend the money on a ramp. Quote, those of you who are having a little trouble grasping the concept of having a parking garage, tonight when you go home, park two blocks from your house, walk home, and do that for a week, said Andy Schimmick, a downtown resident and business owner who attended both sessions. Quote, you'll get an idea of what's going on down here as far as parking. There is a huge problem, and I deal with it all the time, unquote. The input came from the approximately 50 attendees, many of whom represented downtown businesses and organizations, where patrons and residents in that area or involved in Community Main Street, who spoke or listened over about the 3 hours combined between the two sessions. High-ranking city officials also were in attendance at both sessions. Rosenboom was busily scribbling down notes while Foster facilitated the discussion. Additionally, Fishbeck reported having received more than 1,000 responses to the online survey available through March 4th at bit.ly/parkcedarfalls. One of the big challenges identified is that a structure and any system of paid parking around it generates only enough money to maintain the infrastructure, making the upfront cost a barrier for many communities. And as a result, for private developers, it's not seen as a moneymaker. Parking rates for a ramp and an area around the structure would be holistically determined. Those fees are among the many considerations in making the decision about a ramp. Quote, we put the hourly restrictions on stuff so that people can't spend the day parked downtown, visiting multiple places, said Nick Newgard, owner of Second State Brewing. So we're really encouraging people only to come down to one or two places, which, in my opinion, is less likely they'll come down to spend time to park, unquote. Some attendees reminded people of the demographic most needing a ramp and nearby places to park. Quote, when we have productions, that's one of the biggest concerns that a lot of our patrons have, especially 30 to 40% of our patrons being of an older demographic who might not have the ability to walk distances, said Chris Hale, managing director at the Cedar Falls Community Theater. His comments were in contrast to those who think more options like a ramp are not needed. Instead, it's an issue of people not wanting to walk. Quote, sometimes it's just a matter of walking or knowing it's going to take extra time when it's 20 below zero, and when it's 110, it might feel a lot worse, said Karen Fredrickson, who also complimented the, quote, amazing signage detailing how much time is allowed in spots around the downtown. Her comment also hit on whether the concerns arise from a perception based on a few visits during the busiest times. Quote, I think there's a perception that there's no parking because Main Street is always filled up, whereas the district certainly has some available, said Mara Beth Stoneson, a former executive director of Community Main Street. Another concern from some is that a ramp would be an eyesore. The consultants assured the attendees that nowadays they're designed to fit within the fabric of the community. A few brought up Waterloo, where the ramps reportedly sit empty most days. But they were cautioned that it's not an apples-to-apples comparison because of the different states of the two downtowns. Most acknowledge the benefits of a structure if it's pursued as mixed use, serving commercial, residential, or both purposes, in addition to being a place to park. Quote, I think that it would be a missed opportunity, said Jenny Leeper, a resident and property owner. The city council in October contracted with Fishbeck in a 4-3 vote for the latest parking study at a cost of $39,343. It would follow a previous study finalized in 2019, but this one has been described as being more niche to the question of whether a structure is needed and what that could entail. The Image Downtown Vision Plan, adopted in 2019, will also be taken into account, said the consultants. Now let's turn to the editorial section. This editorial comes from the Des Moines Register. To keep Iowa school kids safe from guns, look to research, not more guns. A proposal at the State House to allow teachers and other school employees to carry weapons and to subsidize security guards is the wrong approach to keep Iowa children safe. But it's difficult to articulate alternatives that are both effective and realistic in the wake of three deadly school shootings in central Iowa in less than 3 years. Expert research suggests a sad truth. No set of policies can provide much assurance so long as it remains easy for children to acquire firearms. That's not fatalism. State officials, school boards, school administrators, other educators, parents and guardians, all of them, and more, can and should take actions that might make it less likely a child will be shot on school grounds. But it's maddening to realize that so many interventions are, for practical purposes, off the table anytime soon because of the sheer number of guns in circulation and the prevailing political attitude that almost no benefit could ever justify the slightest complication for people to acquire and carry firearms. What should be done in the here and now? 4 steps could make a difference. Number 1, listen to the research. Research on mass shootings in general, and at schools in particular, is plentiful, although one hurdle to applying it is widespread suspicion of political motives behind any research involving guns in the United States. If the Secret Service is a relatively neutral arbiter, its 2020 report on targeted school violence provides both some help and some sobering realism about perpetrators. Quote, there is no profile of a student attacker, nor is there a profile for the type of school that has been targeted, the authors wrote. Attackers usually had multiple motives. The report adds that many attackers were victims of bullying and had exhibited psychological, behavioral, or developmental symptoms. Many used firearms they got from their homes. The studies on protecting schools do not illuminate a clear direction. Access to schools should be controlled, but going significantly further to make buildings into fortresses can be outrageously expensive and deliver other negative effects for students' psyches. Experts raise similar concerns about the cost and message of metal detectors. And of course, such building measures would not have stopped the drive-by shooting outside East High School that killed a teenager and injured others. Last month's attack at Perry High School occurred before the start of school day in a common area. Based on what is publicly known, it's not clear, even in hindsight, whether access limits might have made any difference. The bottom line, doing something just to be doing something could be a net negative. School safety actions should have evidence to support them. Number two, reject adding more guns to the mix. Debate in Iowa for over a year now has centered on putting weapons in the hands of school staff members. It was a bad idea when the 2023 debate centered on whether insurers were right to threaten to drop schools' coverage if they armed staff. This year, House File 2586 would authorize employees of public and private schools, colleges, and universities to carry weapons. Two separate issues are involved here. The easier to deal with is intervention. A teacher or another employee using a gun to stop an attack. It's absolutely true that this might be beneficial. Sometimes a good guy with a gun does stop a bad guy with a gun. Unfortunately, a good guy with a gun might also make a mistake in securing the weapon, leading to a tragic accident. Perhaps a staff member will overreact to a situation or miss the target when firing. Some children might be less comfortable in class knowing it does or might contain a deadly firearm. The possibility of a successful intervention doesn't outweigh the downsides. School shootings often play out in seconds. In Perry and at the Starts Right Here Charter School in January 2023, how likely is it that armed personnel would have been in the right place to avert bloodshed? Advocates say deterrence is just as important. Shooters are attracted to gun-free zones, the argument goes, and might think twice if Iowa were to pass a law permitting adults in schools to be armed and encouraging districts to employ trained security staff. That puts a lot of faith in often suicidal shooters to act rationally. At best, the deterrence argument provides more support for hardening buildings to restrict access, not for having adults roaming the hallways ready to open fire. Amid bureaucratic delays, most of the $75 million that Iowa set aside in June 2022 to upgrade safety at school buildings has not yet been spent, the Associated Press reported last month. Number three, work to secure weapons. There are way too many guns in America. Iowa is not about to change that, but we can change the culture to demand that adults secure their weapons, similar to how society's tide turned against smoking or going without a seatbelt. According to a database study by the federal government's National Institute of Justice, 80% of people who carried out a mass shooting at a kindergarten to 12th grade school took the firearm they used from a relative. Even parents and guardians who teach responsible gun use to children should not extend their trust to letting children get firearms out themselves. This is a place where throwing money at a problem might produce results. Many biometric gun safes that require an owner's fingerprint before opening retail for about $100. A state that has a multi-billion dollar budget surplus and forks over hundreds of millions of dollars a year for families to spend on private school, can afford to make these freely available to gun owners, removing any excuse for leaving weapons for kids to take. And number four, don't be a stranger. Almost everybody agrees that children's mental health services in Iowa are far from adequate. Leaders are working on legislation to address that complicated problem. But we can't sit back and do nothing until the state has recruited more psychiatrists trained to help children. Each of us can reach out to help a struggling young person. It's not easy to tell in advance, with precision, whether a teenager might become a psychological danger to other people. But speaking up in response to warning signs, such as disturbing social media posts, could help. It's impossible to calculate how often somebody showing interest in a troubled student averts a mass shooting. In Michigan, a jury decided this month that a woman was criminally liable for not doing anything before her son shot four classmates to death with a pistol his parents had bought him as a gift. We need not be bystanders until after a horror show emerges. The Institute for Justice notes the complication that some students will fear discussing concerns about a classmate lest they be labeled a snitch. Still, talking about warning signs might sometimes protect others and convey that someone cares even a little. Could all of this make parents and guardians feel confident that their child won't be the next one murdered at school? Probably not. That will require a seismic shift in the availability of guns. But this is a place to start. This opinion was written by Lucas Grundmeier on behalf of the Register's editorial board. Now let's turn to the obituaries in the Courier today. Thomas Edward, known as Tom Zoil, 81, of Sioux City, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, February 27th, at home, from Lewy body dementia, comforted by family. A small private family memorial service will occur Sunday, March 3rd, 2024, at 11 o'clock a.m., officiated by Chaplain Norm Prather at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel in Sioux City. Final interment will be later this spring at the Correctionville Cemetery in Correctionville, Iowa. Online condolences may be offered to the family at www.meyerbroschapels.com. Tom was born on April 14, 1942, in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, to Jerome and Marion Shea Zoil. He graduated from Goodrich High School with the class of 1960, and was united in marriage to Susan Siebel on April 29, 1961, both in Fond du Lac. After their marriage, Tom worked for Giddings and Lewis as an electronic technician. A new employment opportunity arose as a maintenance electrician at the John Deere Waterloo Tractor Works in Waterloo, Iowa, for which he and Susan moved their family in January of 1976 to Waverly, Iowa. Tom retired from John Deere in 2002 after a long and successful career, but still enjoyed keeping in touch with former co-workers and fellow UAW members. Tom and Sue were longtime residents of Waverly until Sue's death in 2021, and Tom's declining health led to a move to Sioux City, Iowa, to reside with his son Jeff and his wife Taffy and their family in 2022. Tom was a longtime member of Grace Baptist Church in Waverly, being highly involved in many church activities. He enjoyed the outdoors in many facets, including hunting, camping, traveling, and fishing. Many a hunting trip with Tom's beloved dog Abby were enjoyed. Tom especially treasured time with his children and wonderful relationships with his grandchildren. Tom's family would like to thank everyone for their love and support offered to us during this sad time. Cheryl A. Hawker, age 66, of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, formerly of Waterloo, Iowa, passed away on Sunday, February 25, 2024, at Mayo Clinic, St. Mary's Hospital, in Rochester, Minnesota. She was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on January 18, 1958, the daughter of Raymond and Green McKeever Smith. Cheryl grew up in Homewood, Illinois, where she graduated from Homewood Flossmoor High School with the class of 1976. She then attended Robert Morris College in Carthage, Illinois, where she became a certified medical assistant. Cheryl married Chuck Hawker of Homewood, Illinois, on July 15th of 1978. Cheryl and Chuck raised their family in Buffalo, New York, the suburbs of Chicago, and in Waterloo, Iowa. They most recently moved to Prairie du Chien in 2017 and have owned and operated the Sawmill Saloon since 2019. Cheryl enjoyed quilting and visiting with her friends at the picket fence in Prairie du Chien. A memorial service will be Saturday, March 9, 2024, at 3 o'clock p.m. at the Garrity Funeral Home Chapel in Prairie du Chien. Pastor Hillary Burns Kite officiating with private interment at a later date in the Waterloo Cemetery in Waterloo, Iowa. Friends may call at the funeral home on Saturday from 1 o'clock p.m. until the time of the service. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts may be made in honor of Cheryl for the purpose of the palliative care program at Mayo Clinic, Department of Development, 200 First Street, Southwest, Rochester, Minnesota, 55905. Richard C. Fernald, 62, of Independence, Iowa, died Wednesday, February 28, 2024, at his home, following a sudden illness. Funeral services for Rick will be at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, March 4th, at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup, Iowa, with burial at St. Athanasius Cemetery. Visitation will be from 2 o'clock p.m. to 5 o'clock p.m. on Sunday, March 3rd, at the White Funeral Home in Jessup, where there will be a parish rosary at 3 o'clock p.m. Visitation will continue for an hour before services at the church on Monday. Arrangements are being made with White Funeral Home in Jessup, Iowa. Next, in San Antonio, Texas, Kenneth Erickson, 91, of San Antonio, Texas, passed away on February 22nd at the Army Residence Community in San Antonio, Texas. He was a longtime resident of the Ark and will be missed by many friends and staff there. Born in South Dakota and raised in Cohasset and Grand Rapids, Minnesota, Ken married his high school sweetheart, Mary McDonsky, in 1952. In Minnesota, they raised four children. A Korean War veteran, Ken used the GI Bill to complete his education and earned his B.A. and M.A. in education from Bemidji State University. He was an elementary teacher in Minnesota. In 1969, the family moved to Waterloo, Iowa, where Ken served as an elementary school principal, working for the Waterloo school system until his retirement in 1992. Ken and Mary were married for 33 years until she died in 1986. While working as a principal, Ken continued his Army career and retired at the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the Army Reserve. Ken met his second wife, Sarah Scandlin, at a church singles group during a dance event. They were married at the Little Brown Church in Nashua, Iowa, in 1993. Sarah, his devoted wife, was with him till the end. Golfing was his passion, and he played regularly until he had to use a walker. As a Shriner, he was a clown for events and parades. He also deeply loved his grandchildren and great-grandchildren, who were fortunate to have spent a lot of time with him, learning to play golf and cribbage. He will be missed by many. In Buckingham, Neil A. Hemshute, 91, passed away on February 17th in Traer, Iowa. Neil was born September 5th, 1932, to Adolph and Margaret Hemshute, where Neil was later known by many names, including Dad, Brother, Papa, Grandpa, That Guy, and Duke. He married Sylvia Randall before he entered the Navy, where he served as an aircraft radio electrician. He and Sylvia had five children and later divorced. After serving in the Navy, Neil was a proud farmer, rural mail carrier, and drove a maintainer for Tama County. He had the cleanest bean fields around because his grumbling children helped to walk the fields. People on his mail route knew what time of day it was because Neil always showed up at the same time. Neil cherished visits with family, including Jerry and Carol and his brother Bob, and fishing buddies like Rick, Kobe, Bob, and Charlie. He had many interests, including fishing in Minnesota, gardening, playing Pepper, giving rides on the orange tractor to his grandchildren, watching Judge Judy, and Big Bang Theory, cheering on the twins, and telling stories of old Three Toes. Neil enjoyed a variety of foods, including Spam, fresh tomatoes from the garden, pockets full of donut holes, clam chowder, full pepper grinders, and who could forget his secret recipe? And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, March 4th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.